This is the Sports Illustrated Boxing Podcast.
It's boxing.
A look inside boxing with Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix. Interviews, analysis, and everything going on in boxing. And now a man who I wish was called the Boston Bleeder.
All doctors to the ER.
It's sort of like getting punched in the face.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back to the SI Boxing Podcast. Glad you could join me this week. A lot to get into in the world of boxing. A couple of big fights coming up over the next couple of weeks, all heading into Deontay Wilder against Tyson Fury, that big matchup on February 22nd. To break it all down and more, I welcome back Keith Idek, senior boxing writer over at BoxingScene.com. Keith, what's up, man?
Hey, Chris, how you doing?
I'm good, man. I'm good. Just a lot of interesting stuff in boxing going on right now. It's been an interesting few days in boxing. And in the land of mythical matchups, it's been pretty interesting. And I guess I want to start there. Just this past week, we had Conor McGregor return to the UFC, reestablish himself both as a high-level UFC fighter and one of the biggest draws in all of combat sports. The UFC reported that McGregor did, I think, roughly 2 million, the equivalent of 2 million pay-per-view buys with their system. A big number, especially since he was fighting a guy with like 13 losses who he was heavily favored to go up against. But all of a sudden, instead of talking about McGregor and UFC fights, we're kind of pivoting back to McGregor in boxing. You had Mayweather putting out a tweet saying, or social media post saying, that he's ready to fight him in 2020 to rematch. Manny Pacquiao wants him in 2020. And now Bob Arum says that Terrence Crawford is ready to fight a two-fight match against a matchup against McGregor, where Crawford would step into an MMA octagon first, and then McGregor would fight him in boxing. So give me your overall viewpoint of this. What do you make of now all these boxers, again, clamoring for a shot at Conor McGregor?
Well, not the type of fights we're looking to see, of course, Chris. I don't have any interest, and I couldn't imagine anyone else in their right mind would have any interest in seeing Floyd Mayweather and Conor McGregor box again. There would be interest, of course, if Floyd, for some reason, would be willing to fight him in a UFC or some sort of variation of mixed martial arts rules type of fight. That isn't going to happen. We well know that. So let's take that off the table. I can't see Conor McGregor fighting Manny Pacquiao. There are too many options for Manny Pacquiao in boxing matches. Against boxers. I don't think Manny would even entertain fighting him in some sort of MMA fight. But there are appealing options for Manny Pacquiao in boxing now that he's with PBC. There's the Errol Spence fight. There's Danny Garcia. There are people that he can be matched against later this year when he comes back to the ring. And then the one that was thrust upon us yesterday by Bob Arum is the Terrence Crawford Conor McGregor fight, which makes a little bit more sense because Terrence Crawford has a wrestling background. He wasn't a high level wrestler, as far as I know. He wrestled in middle school. I mean, I played basketball in middle school. What does that mean exactly? It's not like he could compete with Conor McGregor at the highest level in some sort of mixed martial arts fight. Now, Terrence Crawford is a very competitive guy, and he said all the right things yesterday. But to be honest, Chris, I think this is just a smokescreen from Bob Arum because they want you to take some attention away from the fact that Terrence Crawford does not have any boxers to fight. There's no known opponent for his next fight. They've already satisfied his mandatory commitment to the WBO by fighting Kavalauskas last month at the Garden. He can't get any of these fights against the PBC fighters that he wants, at least for the time being. Errol Spence, Manny Pacquiao. We thought there was a possibility that he could fight Sean Porter. All of a sudden, him and Sean Porter are such good friends that they can't fight. That was the one PBC top-ranked fight that we thought we could see at welterweight. They decided that they don't want to do it. So what is there for Terrence Crawford at this point? So here's Bob Arum, pulling a page out of his old promotional tricks and, making a story into something that we know is not going to happen. Terrence Crawford is not going to fight Conor McGregor in an MMA fight first and then fight him in a boxing match second. It makes no sense. Why would Terrence? They would make a lot of money and people would be interested in it. And I'm not saying it wouldn't draw mainstream attention and all that. But what does that really do for Terrence Crawford's legacy or career? He's 32 years old, Chris. He'll be 33 years old in September. He's starting to get to the point where he's going to move out of his physical prime without having fought the type of fights at welterweight that we want to see him in. I just don't see how fighting Conor McGregor in a UFC fight does. It will make him a lot of money, and I'm not saying that's not an important factor in this. But other than that, what purpose would it serve for Terrence Crawford to do that?
Yeah, I don't think it serves Crawford much, if any, purpose, except, as you said, to make a boatload of money in a couple of major events that would be watched by a lot of people. But it doesn't advance him in the boxing world at all. It doesn't advance him as the top fighter that he wants to be in all of boxing. I think the only fight in boxing that makes sense for Conor McGregor, and I think it's a fight that unfortunately we're getting more and more likely to see, is that rematch against Floyd Mayweather. I don't know about you, Keith, and it's not. I've been getting a pretty strong sense that not only is Floyd going to come back this year, but there's a pretty decent chance he fights twice in 2020. And those two people that come up are McGregor in a rematch first, which would, you know, be the equivalent for Floyd of kind of shaking off all that rust and, you know, taking what would be undoubtedly a very easy win for him and a big payday. And then that rematch with Manny Pacquiao before the end of the year. I've just had too many people, you know, not necessarily first-hand information, but second and third-hand information that they believe that's the direction that Floyd's going to go. And I didn't have any interest in Floyd McGregor the first time. I was very vocal about it, that it was nonsensical, but and I feel the same way the second time. I don't have any interest in it, but I do think that's where it's trending right now.
Well, here's the thing, Chris. If he were to fight Manny Pacquiao, if he were to come back for a fight in, you know, May or July or whenever, and decided to fight Manny Pacquiao again, you could make the argument that Manny Pacquiao claims that his shoulder injury was a big reason why he was not as competitive as people might have expected in their first fight. Manny Pacquiao obviously has looked better in recent years. He just beat Keith Thurman, who, say what you will about where Thurman was in his career, was 10 years younger than him and an undefeated welterweight champion. So Pacquiao has accomplished some things since he fought Mayweather the first time, and whether anyone believes it or not, is using that excuse to say that their rematch would be competitive. And they are the two biggest names in boxing, and their rematch, I don't think it would do the type of business necessarily that their first fight did, but it would still do bigger business than any other boxing match that can be made. Whereas the McGregor-Mayweather rematch, there is, as you said, there was no point to them fighting the first time other than making a lot of money, which is, again, a huge factor. What possible reason could anyone have for wanting to see that again? There's no conceivable reason why they should box again. The first fight was not remotely competitive. He stopped them in the fight. Conor McGregor is no better of a boxer today than he was in August 2017. It would be farcical if they, it was kind of farcical that they fought the first time. It would be even more so the second time. But I do think that if he comes back and fights Manny Pacquiao, even though Floyd will turn 43 next month and Manny Pacquiao is 41, there will still be interest in that fight because they're the two most known names in boxing.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that in the case of Floyd versus Pacquiao, you can make a reasonable argument that a nearly three-year layoff for Mayweather coinciding with Pacquiao fighting at a reasonably high level. I mean, he was in the conversation for Fighter of the Year last year with wins over Adrian Broner and a win over Keith Thurman, that sort of levels the playing field a little bit, and Pacquiao being more active and all that stuff. So I could certainly see that being a sellable and understandable fight. I'm with you on McGregor, though. I just feel like we're going to see it. I just feel like that Mayweather and Dana White, and they're going to get together and roll the dice and believe that there's 2 million people out there that will pay to see that particular fight. I'm not a fan of it, but I unfortunately feel like that's a possibility. In the world of real boxing, I reported yesterday over at SI.com that Canelo Alvarez has turned his attention to Ryota Murata, the Japanese fighter who holds a secondary middleweight title as Canelo searches for his next opponent in 2020. Previously, they'd been having some conversations about Billy Joe Saunders internally, but as Canelo has been vocal about wanting to fight over in Japan, Murata would be the guy that you fight over in Japan. He is enormously popular, and a Canelo-Murata fight would do probably 50,000 people plus inside the Tokyo Dome or some other venue like that. So, Keith, what do you make of Canelo turning his attention to Murata for his next fight?
Well, it would be an enormous event in Japan, Chris, as you said, because the Tokyo Dome can hold somewhere between 55 and 60,000 people for boxing. They would clearly sell that out. While it would be an enormous event in Japan and they would all make a lot of money, I go back to almost what I said about McGregor-Terrence Crawford. What does that do for Canelo Alvarez's legacy? And he's obviously taken a lot of difficult fights. I'm not criticizing his resume in any way. But what does this fight do for him? Why would he, if he was going to move back down to middleweight, the fight that everyone wants to see, as we've talked about ad nauseum, is the third fight against Gennady Golovkin. Maybe, you know, depending on who you ask, maybe they want to see him fight Jermall Charlo more, or they want to see him fight Demetrius Andrade and then see him fight Golovkin again. But those are the fights people want to see Canelo Alvarez in at middleweight. No one wants to see him fight Murata. Murata has lost to Hassan Ndam and lost to Rob Brandt. And while he came back to avenge both of those losses, you can't take away the fact that he lost those two fights. He's just not that good. He's a very popular fighter in Japan. He's a top 10 middleweight, but there's no reason whatsoever for Canelo Alvarez to fight him. And Canelo is going to make a lot of money no matter who he fights. So you couldn't make the argument, oh, it's going to be such a big event. He's going to make so much money. He's going to make money no matter who he fights. So I just don't see how this helps him in any way. And then it would require, I guess, him for the, you know, this Mexican holiday, this Cinco de Mayo weekend, I guess it would be May 2nd this year. That's been a big thing for them to fight in Las Vegas on that weekend, either before, after, or on the actual day. So are they going to go away from that to go to Japan for a fight that, if they do wind up doing it, could be done later in the year? I don't know. I'm not saying from a commercial standpoint that it doesn't make sense, but otherwise, I just don't understand it at all. Do you?
Not really, in the sense that I'm with you on how competitive it would be. I mean, I think Canelo would stop Murata violently in that fight. It would just, I don't think Murata is anywhere near his class. And Murata may have to move up to 168 pounds to take that fight, where he'd be even less effective, I think, as a guy like Canelo. The only argument I make kind of for it, Keith, is that there are, like, I want to see Golovkin a third time as well. But that was off the table for May. That is not under consideration right now for May. We can argue that it should be, but it's not. The three fighters they're kicking around are Murata, Callum Smith, and Billy Joe Saunders, with Saunders, I think, kind of waiting in the wings in case he decides to fight in Las Vegas on May 2nd. So it's really Saunders or Murata. And, like, Saunders, I guess, technically, you know, there's a real title at stake, and he would be a real four-division champion and all that stuff. But how many times we sat here and said Canelo is kind of above the titles? Like, he's not, it's not necessarily, he's not tied to those titles in the way other fighters have been tied to. So if he wants to go and fight Murata, all right, whatever. It doesn't get me any more or less excited than a Billy Joe Saunders fight would be. What I care about is, like, let's say DAZN gives Canelo this, says, we're going to pay you the same money to go over to Japan. They'll do the fight in the morning local time, so they make sure they ensure a primetime audience in the U.S. But that's it. Like, you fight Murata, you have got to fight Golovkin in September in the U.S. Give us the fight that we've been paying out of our pockets for over the last year plus to try to make happen. So if Murata, like, greases the skids for a Golovkin fight in September, I'm kind of okay with it in that respect.
Of course, we don't know that will happen. I'm with you, Chris. If that were the guarantee that he gave them that he'll fight Golovkin in September, yeah, I guess. But if there's no guarantee of that, because he's been so adamant about not fighting him again, how many people are you going to allow him to fight that people don't want to see before you just put your foot down and say, hey, look, we're paying the money. Yes, he's the talent, and he's an elite talent, and he's unquestionably the biggest star in American boxing, the biggest active star in American boxing. There's no doubt about that. At what point, though, does DAZN say, we're paying the money, this is getting ridiculous now? I'm not faulting him for fighting Kovalev, because whatever people think of where Kovalev was and how soon it was after he fought Anthony Yard, he was still moving up two weight classes and fought a guy who could punch at 175 pounds. So I'm not discrediting him for that. But he has fought Rocky Fielding. And if he were to fight Murata, then, you know, two of his four fights with DAZN will have been gimmies, so to speak. That's a lot of gimmies when you're paying $35 million plus per fight. So I don't know if they're going to allow, you know, you might have more insight to that than I do, but I don't know if they're going to allow that again. But as you said, if they do guarantee that he'll fight Golovkin in September, maybe they allow him to do it. But I just don't see what anyone gets out of that. And particularly if Murata had to move up to 168 pounds, he'd be even less effective then. And what you mentioned about Billy Joe Saunders and Callum Smith, I'm not saying that those are the two guys that I want to see him fight above all others, but I would much rather see him fight Billy Joe Saunders, who clearly gets up for the more difficult fights. And I think, although he didn't look good in his last fight, and neither did Callum Smith, I think both of them would get up for what would be the biggest fights of their the biggest fight of their career if either one of them were to fight Canelo. So I would much rather see Saunders and Canelo or Smith and Canelo than Murata Canelo, and I can't imagine many other people wouldn't agree with that if you don't live in Japan.
Yeah, I'm with you that, yeah, they're better fights, like no question about it. Billy Joe Saunders, even though I think Callum's a better fighter, Billy Joe Saunders could talk a lot and would talk a lot in the build-up, and I think that would create some legitimate buzz for a fight like that. I think it's got to be, there's got to be a package deal here. Like, you get Murata, we'll go there and make that fight if you're DAZN, but you have to get Golovkin in the fall. And from DAZN's perspective, one thing you have to look at with the business model is that they're huge in Japan. Like I think Japan is one of, if not the top market for DAZN because of all the baseball games that they broadcast over there. So there's a business reason why it might make sense for them to go over there. But either way, you have got to get Golovkin on the books, because this is it, Keith. In 2020, I don't know if you agree with this, but to me, this is it. Like, you give Golovkin his mandatory, which is probably going to happen either late March or early April, assuming that goes the way we expect, where he knocks this kid out and he gets a little bit more momentum going after that Derevyanchenko fight. If you don't make the fight in September, it becomes utterly pointless. At that point, Golovkin is going to be pushing 40 after that, and then it just becomes ridiculous, because then you have to give Golovkin a real fighter, and there's a pretty good chance that Golovkin would lose either to rematch with Derevyanchenko, Demetrius Andrade, somebody else. This is it. It is, you know, shit or get off the pot time when it comes for Canelo and Gennady Golovkin. If he takes this Murata fight, he's got to take Golovkin next, because if you don't, there's almost no reason to do Golovkin at all.
I agree with you, Chris. We're almost at the point of the expiration date expiring here for that fight. And it's sort of why I don't understand why Canelo didn't jump at the opportunity to fight Golovkin a third time before now, because it's a diminished Golovkin. The fight against Derevyanchenko was a brutal fight for both guys, and I think that probably took something out of Golovkin, and he's older now, and the Canelo fights weren't, I don't think, as physically taxing as the Derevyanchenko fight, but were tough fights also. So I just think his age combined with the amount of tough fights that he's had over the last couple of years would be the perfect time. You know, that combination would make it the perfect time for Canelo to fight him. And how would you get the best revenge possible against Golovkin, a fighter that he does not like and who has said a lot of negative things about him that he has taken to heart and never forgotten? What's the best way to get your revenge against that guy than to fight him a third time and maybe knock him out? I'm not saying he would for sure knock him out, but it seems like he would have a much better opportunity to stop Golovkin inside the distance in their third fight than he had in the first two fights based on what's happened since the second fight. So I'm a little surprised that Canelo's, from a business opportunity, just being an opportunist and fighting people at the right time, I don't know why he wouldn't want to fight Golovkin at this point, other than his clear hatred for him, which I'm surprised has gotten in the way of them not fighting a third time.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Canelo constantly says, "I love challenges," and I get that about him, but Golovkin still represents a reasonable challenge, and there are so many business reasons to make that fight happen before the end of the year. So I hope that everybody gets on the same page. If he does go to Japan to fight Murata, there's got to be a clear agreement that Gennady Golovkin is next for Canelo Alvarez. Sticking in the middleweight division for a second, it seems like you and I have many conversations about Jermall Charlo and his future and when he's going to be in a significant fight of his own. The WBC made some moves over the last week where they installed Sergey Derevyanchenko as the number one contender, suggesting, and I say suggesting because these rules are often a movable feast, but suggesting that Derevyanchenko is next in line for a shot that WBC title that Charlo owns. There's been some talk about Charlo versus Chris Eubank, who fought on his undercard just this past December. You and I have constantly talked about Demetrius Andrade, if that fight will happen. What do you think is next for Jermall Charlo?
My best guess, Chris, is that he'll fight Eubank next. I wasn't particularly impressed with the first round of how Eubank looked against Matt Kharbov before Kharbov got hurt. But Eubank is a name fighter. He came to PBC because he wanted to fight guys like Jermall Charlo. They'll be able to sell that fight as somewhat of a step up in opponent for Jermall Charlo. I would expect that fight to happen next, and then maybe his next fight, when the mandatory would actually be due against Derevianchenko, maybe he would fight Derevianchenko then. That's a good fight. I mean, you could argue that Derevianchenko beat Golovkin in that fight. It was a very close fight. I think you could make the argument either way for which guy won. But that would be a really good opponent for Charlo. Derevianchenko's only two losses are a very close loss to Golovkin, very close loss to Daniel Jacobs, two elite middleweights. So, you know, he would be the best opponent of Charlo's career. And I think that would be the blueprint for Jermall Charlo in 2020, assuming he doesn't fight Canelo or someone of, you know, or maybe Demetrius Andrade. Also don't discount Daniel Jacobs, because I still think that I don't know that Jacobs would want to go all the way back down to middleweight, or if he really physically could. But maybe they would fight at some sort of catchweight, because that would still be a pretty big fight. And there's some beef between them over the years, and I think that's a sellable fight at Barclays Center. So I think that could also be an option for Charlo later in the year. But I would love to see a Charlo Derevianchenko fight. I'm assuming most people would. He would be the best opponent that he's fought.
I think that's an excellent fight for both guys, and one that should make them a decent amount of money, whether it's fighting on Showtime or on Fox. I would just say this to Jermall Charlo. I hope he's getting paid. If you go in there with Sergey Derevianchenko, which is a very tough fight, Derevianchenko has lost twice to Jacobs and to Golovkin, two elite middleweights, and lost by the skin of his teeth, like just barely lost both those fights. You better be getting paid for taking on that type of challenge. You know, with all due respect, Keith, to our friend Tim Smith, who seemed to suggest that there wasn't an offer from Eddie Hearn, there was an offer. I have literally seen the email that Eddie Hearn sent to Jermall Charlo making the offer. Paul Andrade, the father of Demetrius Andrade, told me it was for $7 million. So you better be getting paid. If you're turning down $7 million to defend your title at middleweight against another title holder in a major fight, a major event, you better be getting paid something comparable, or else I don't know what we're doing in this game. If you you and I talk about this all the time, but you know, Andrade's out there with a title and a boatload of money to throw at a potential opponent, and nobody seems interested in fighting him. So if you're Charlo and you're going to be willing to put yourself in there with Derevianchenko, who could beat you, you better make sure you're getting at least $7 million to do it. That's my take on it. Like, if he wants to fight Derevianchenko, great, but make sure you get paid for it, man, because Charlo knows what the offer was. I mean, and Charlo knows how real that offer was from Andrade's side.
Well, the other thing too, Chris, not to forget about, is Oscar De La Hoya just revealed the other day, I think it was Monday when they were promoting this Ryan Garcia fight. He said that you know, last year they made an offer to not directly to Charlo himself, but Oscar seemed a little unclear on who the offer was actually made to, but it was made to PBC, right, on Charlo's behalf for what he called a very, very lucrative offer, which probably exceeded $7 million if he was going to fight Canelo. So now, you know, that fight would have had to have happened on DAZN, of course, and that maybe was one of the stumbling blocks. But he's been offered a lot of money to fight Canelo. He's been offered a lot of money to fight Andrade, and both of those fights haven't happened. And then the other thing to consider if he is going to fight Derevianchenko is how much money is it going to cost altogether to satisfy both sides for them to make that fight? Because as you know, Derevianchenko made over $5 million to fight Golovkin. He's not going to take $1 million to fight Charlo. You know, I'm not saying he would make more necessarily to fight Charlo than he made to fight Golovkin because of what DAZN is paying in purses, and Golovkin's a bigger star than Charlo overall. But it's going to cost a lot of money if they put that fight together, and it might have to be a pay-per-view fight. And then you have to wonder, while it's a very good fight and boxing fans would really enjoy it and want to see it, is it pay-per-view worthy in the sense that you would do enough buys for it to make financial sense overall?
Yeah, at a minimum, I would think a Charlo Derevianchenko fight in today's marketplace, what guys are getting paid, is a $5 million fight. I think that combine the two purses, it's probably going to be at least $5 million, maybe more. I think that's conservative in saying $5 million. And I don't know, is Showtime going to be able to put up that type of money? Is Fox? I mean, or does it have to go on pay-per-view where you're taking a massive risk that you can get, you know, six-figure buys to make it worth the the price you're paying for that. So I don't know. I mean, the Charlo stuff just, and I'd love to sit down with him sometime on this podcast or just do a column on him, like the thinking behind it. Because when you get into boxing, right, you're doing it because you want to make a lot of money and be in big fights. And if it's true what Oscar said, that he turned down an offer to fight Canelo for, I assume, for pretty good money, you know, in the $5 million-ish dollar range, maybe more, what are we doing? If you're turning down $7 million to fight Demetrius Andrade, what are we doing? Like, I don't understand what the thinking is in Charlo's camp about why, as he is in his physical prime, why he's turning down these types of fights. I mean, maybe you have some more insight into it. Like, what his philosophy is. Like, what does he want out of his career? Because 2019, the kind of fights he took, that can't be it, can it?
You wouldn't think, but one thing I will say, and we don't know the total purses because as you well know, Chris, what's reported to the commission is often not the total compensation package for the fighter. So I've been led to believe that Jermall Charlo, I'm not saying he's making $7 million a fight, he's not, but he's making very good money. So he's making multi-million dollar purses by the time he's paid what's on the commission contract, what he's being paid on the side. I've been told that there are win bonuses in some cases for the champions for making title defenses for PBC. And I don't know the figures or the percentages of all those, but if there are essentially three revenue streams for one purse or compensation package, whatever you want to call it, guys like Jermall Charlo are being well paid, because if they weren't, they would be much more vocal about not getting the fights that they want. So if you're him, and I'm just throwing this number out there, I don't know that this is the number, but just for argument's sake, say he made somewhere between $2 and $3 million to fight Dennis Hogan. He's not going to complain about that, because the risk-reward there is excellent. That math is very favorable for him, because he's being paid a lot of money for a fight in which he's not really at as much risk as he would be for guys like Andrade or certainly Canelo, Daniel Jacobs, any of those guys, really. So Derevianchenko, Golovkin, of course, all of those guys. But so if he's being paid well and he's taking lesser risks and he's satisfied with that temporarily, he's going to go along with the plan for now. And that's essentially what he's done. I think as a competitor and at heart, you'd have to believe that he wants the biggest fights available before his career. Because, you know, when he's sitting back 20 years from now, money is more important than anything else. And who you fought when you're 50 years old is not going to matter much if you can't pay your bills and you can't send your kids to college and all that kind of stuff. So money is the primary motivating factor for, I would assume, all of these guys, despite that some of them tell us it's legacy. And I'm not saying legacy isn't important to a lot of them, but money ultimately is the foremost factor for these guys, I think. And if he's being paid well now and he can bank some money before he gets to the type of fights that he wants, whether that comes at age 31 or 32 or 33, I think for the time being he would be okay with that. And that seems to be the case.
I get it, but to make like a gambling comparison, like Jermall Charlo is like the guy at the craps table just placing $5 pass line bets while the guy next to him is on a heater. Like the kid is an excellent fighter. And if you step in and fight Demetrius Andrade, I don't know. I think it's a close fight. I think Andrade's probably the better fighter, but Charlo is also an excellent fighter. You beat Demetrius Andrade, all of a sudden, not only do you have the $7 million check, you got two titles, and you become a strong favorite to get a Canelo fight and an even bigger payday there. So he's kind of, I get it, Keith. He's following a path where he's taking low risk and relatively high reward. But if he increases the risk a little bit, the reward is exponentially higher. I mean, we saw what Daniel Jacobs got to fight Canelo, that $12 million range. If Charlo beat Demetrius Andrade, let's just say hypothetically went on to beat Derevianchenko in the next fight, I mean, the guy'd be worth at least that to fight Canelo Alvarez in 2021. I just think taking a little bit more risk, I get that there's a danger in it, but there's also an enormous financial reward, isn't there, if he rolls the dice a little bit?
Yeah, because look what Danny Jacobs has done, right? Daniel Jacobs took two risks against the two best middleweights of this era, basically, right? And he was paid more than $15 million combined for both of those fights, between fighting Golovkin and Canelo. So, yeah, I mean, and the Golovkin fight was very, very close. I think Canelo beat Jacobs convincingly, as I think most people would say. But he was compensated extremely well. I mean, he Daniel Jacobs won't have to work again if he's smart enough with the money, and his manager, Keith Conley, is going to do his best to make sure that he is. So I think people look favorably at Jacobs because he's fought the best over the last couple of years. I mean, he didn't shy away from fighting the top guys, and he was paid well for it. So I don't think people would look at Daniel Jacobs more favorably if he were – well, he wouldn't be undefeated because he had already lost. But if he had two less losses on his record, I don't think people would look at him in a more positive light than they look at him now, despite that he lost those two fights.
Yeah, he has two losses on his resume to the best. And as we sit here in 2020, he is still a sought-after opponent who brings money to the table and prestige to the table. I mean, Callum Smith and Billy Joe Saunders, they'd love to get a shot at Daniel Jacobs, even though they are the recognized title holder. It's a great point that the path he followed in the last 2 years is something that all fighters, you know, Charlo in particular, I think should pay some attention to. Let's turn attention to another fight that could happen in 2020. That's Regis Prograe and Maurice Hooker. Both these guys have made some noise about wanting to fight each other. I saw Hooker speaking recently about it. Hooker is affiliated with DAZN. Regis Prograe, unaffiliated right now, but you know, there's a relationship there with Lou DiBella, working with Eddie Hearn before, and other behind-the-scenes people. Do you think we're getting closer to seeing Regis Prograe versus Mo Hooker, a terrific fight at 140 pounds, at some point in the first half of this year?
I hope so, Chris. It's an interesting fight, and I'd like to see how Hooker could, you know, he'll fight a smaller southpaw and see how his chin would hold up against a pretty big puncher in Regis Prograe. I hope we see that fight. Right now, they're just apart on the money, I think, on both sides of it. I don't think Hooker or Prograe is happy with what they've been offered so far. Compensating fighters has, as you well know, not been an issue for DAZN so far, so I would expect that those offers are bumped up to the point where we will see that fight, because there's no one naturally for those two guys to fight right now other than each other that people are all that interested in, unless they were to move up to welterweight, and I think both are better suited for the time being, at least, to fight at junior welterweight. So I really do hope we see that fight, but what I've been led to believe over the last couple of days on both sides of it is that they're looking for more money before they would agree to do that fight.
Yeah, and like you said, I think DAZN, with its checkbook, is probably willing to bump that up a little bit. And I love that fight, Keith, because you've got two guys coming off losses, Prograde's last fight, Mo Hooker, two fights before that. But you also have an opportunity for both to really springboard themselves back into the upper echelon of the 140-pound fighters. Obviously, we're waiting to see what happens with Jose Ramirez and Josh Taylor, but the winner of Hooker versus Prograe would be right there next in line as the number three guy in the division, and heir, really, to fight the winner of that fight if the winner of that fight stays at 140. That's a terrific fight that I hope we get to see sometime in the next 4 or 5 months. Let me ask you about Andy Ruiz for a second here. Some news broke in the last 24 hours about Ruiz, who has parted ways with trainer Manny Robles. Before we get to anything else, let's just talk about that for a second. Manny Robles takes Andy Ruiz to one of the biggest upsets in heavyweight boxing history just like 7 or 8 months ago, and now he eats his way out of contention to win the rematch, comes in way overweight, doesn't pay attention to Manny Robles, and now Manny Robles is out? I mean, what do you make of Andy Ruiz's decision there?
Well, it's always the trainer's fault, right? I mean, it's never the fighter's fault. That's the way boxing history has played out for the most part. But, Manny Robles is a very good trainer. He was very honest both before and after the fight and said, hey, look, we warned him as we moved closer to the fight, get it together. Your weight is too high. You know, let's really start training. Take this more seriously. Let's go, let's go, let's go. And Ruiz did what he did and came in 15 pounds heavier than he did for the first fight. And we all know what happened thereafter. So I'm not surprised because it's the trainer is almost always the fall guy for a fighter losing. I haven't heard specifically what Andy Ruiz said about parting ways with his trainer. I don't know if he was unhappy about the criticism that Manny Robles offered after the fight, but he was being honest, and we welcome that as reporters, of course, Chris, right? We want to hear guys tell us the truth and not sugarcoat everything, and I think Manny was honest about it, but I think he likes Andy and clearly did a great job with him. They pulled off one of the biggest upsets in boxing history in last June, so it'll be interesting to see which direction he goes in for his next trainer, but this is on him. He lost this opportunity to cement himself as one of the two, top guys in the heavyweight division, along with Deontay Wilder at the moment, or three, I guess, with Tyson Fury, you could say. And he blew it. That's not Manny Robles' fault. So, you know, I'm not surprised that it happened, because it almost always happens that way. It's just unfortunate.
Yeah, it often happens that way. But when it does happen, it often is the case of, like, a couple of bad fights, or you could see some kind of buildup to that happening. This was like, I mean, I was in Saudi Arabia when Andy Ruiz, after the fight, looked over at Manny Robles and apologized to him, said he was sorry for screwing around that entire training camp and not taking it seriously and not listening to him. So I'd love to hear the backstory. I know that, you know, Steve Kim over at ESPN said that Al Haymon ordered according to Andy Ruiz's father, Al Haymon instructed them to fire Manny Robles. I'm not sure that that's true. I don't know that that makes any sense. But, you know, I'd love to hear from Andy Ruiz about the decision and which way he ultimately goes next. But where he goes next with a trainer is interesting. Where he goes next as a fighter, I think, is also interesting, Keith. I was with Eddie Hearn briefly in New York this week, and they're dead serious about making Andy Ruiz against Dillian White at some point in the next few months in the U.S. They have made multiple offers to Andy Ruiz to take that fight. And from what I get from their sense is that there is real interest from Ruiz's side in fighting Dillian White. I personally, Keith, I like that fight a lot. You've got almost, I don't want to call it a crossroads fight necessarily, but you've got two guys, you know, one a former champion, one, you know, on the cusp of being a champion who's fought a lot of good fighters in his career in Dillian White. I would love to see them make that fight happen. What do you think of that fight, and what do you think the chances are that Andy Ruiz will cross over again to fight a matchroom fighter?
I think it would be a fun fight, Chris, and I would like to see it. But if, from a business perspective, if I were Andy Ruiz, and of course it always comes down to money, so if they offer him an outrageous amount of money, maybe he'll jump at the chance. But if I were him, I would, as PBC is prone to do, as you see with Adam Konofsky and, you know, fighting Robert Hellenius and Chris Areola and guys like that on Fox, if I were Andy Ruiz, I would try to remain in the PBC universe, take fights against Chris Areola. Would be, you know, they know each other well and they're both Mexicans, and, you know, they still think Areola has something left, or after whatever you make of the Konofsky fight, but that would be a fight I could see them doing on Fox. And then they would have the former heavyweight champion who pulled off this huge upset and is on the comeback trail after learning from his mistakes, and they could sell that on Fox, that type of fight, and maybe another top 15-ish heavyweight, and then try to get him to a fight with Deontay Wilder. Of course, Wilder would have to beat Tyson Fury twice. I understand that. But if I were Ruiz, that would probably be the model I would follow, just because he would make good money for fighting Areola or people like Areola to keep him busy for 2020, and then potentially fight Wilder, and he would make a ton of money for that fight because he's the guy. If they can't make Joshua Wilder, which who knows at this point, but if they can't make that fight, the next best thing would be to get him in the ring with the guy who beat Joshua. And I think Wilder Ruiz would be a, you know, would be a big fight for PBC. So I think if I were him, unless you're offered crazy money to fight Dillian White, that's the way I would go.
Yeah, I'm with you on everything you said there. I mean, I would, as a fan, I'd love to see Ruiz against Dillian White. I think it's a fun fight and a relevant fight in the heavyweight division. But if you're Andy Ruiz, you kind of got to look three steps ahead, right? You got to say, all right, if I take a easy comeback fight in the next time out on an undercard or something, and then maybe I fight an Areola or a Konofsky and build myself up, I am in line for a big-time payday to fight Deontay Wilder. Look, I think Ruiz, because of his chin, is a real threat to Deontay Wilder if that winds up being a fight over the next 18 months that comes together. So as much as I'd like to see it, I would understand if it didn't come together. But, you know, as you said at the top of it, Keith, it does come down to money. And, you know, Eddie Hearn is pretty serious about making a big fight for Dillian White in the U.S. And if he does make some kind of big offer, he might make it just too hard for Andy Ruiz to ultimately refuse. Let me finish, Keith, talking about Danny Garcia. You'll be there ringside on Saturday when Garcia comes back and fights Ivan Redkach. Garcia, of course, was supposed to fight Errol Spence around this time. The Spence injuries, I've taken that off the table. Redkach, I mean, look, call it what it is. It's a gimme for Danny Garcia. Unless something shocking happens, Garcia's going to come in there, look great, knock him out, and that'll be the end of it. But how do you see this fight, and what's at stake for a guy like Garcia in a fight like this?
You know, I'm with you, Chris, in the sense that I would think Danny Garcia would win this fight convincingly. He's a natural welterweight as opposed to Ivan Redkach, who, you know, started his career at lightweight and has only fought at welterweight one time. Garcia is a 25-1 favorite going into this fight, and for good reason. What I will say, though, is when I drove down to Philadelphia last weekend, I sure didn't expect Jason Rosario to knock out Julian Williams. And so that was the second time already. We're only, we're 3 weeks into January, basically, and we've already had two favored fighters from Philadelphia lose in televised main events. So it's just worth noting, at least. I'm not saying that Red Cash is going to beat Danny Garcia. What I am saying is the first fight was Jesse Hart against Joe Smith Jr. Now, Jesse Hart was a 4-1 favorite going into that fight, and I couldn't for the life of me figure that out, and I told anyone who would listen...
Insanity.
I told anyone who would listen leading up to that fight that Joe Smith is going to beat Jesse Hart, for whatever that's worth. But I certainly did not expect Jason Rosario to come into Julian Williams' hometown and knock him out in the fifth round. So anything is possible, and I think it's sort of a storyline going into this fight, being that Danny Garcia, like Julian Williams and like Jesse Hart, is from Philadelphia. So it's something that's going to be discussed at the press conference later today and is going to be talked about going into the fight and everything. I don't think that Danny Garcia has a great chin. It's been one of his greatest assets as a fighter over the last 10 years or so. So I don't expect him to have many problems with Ivan Redcash. He's a 25-1 favorite, as I said, for a reason. But it's setting him up for the type of fights that he wants. And those two fights, of course, are against Errol Spence Jr. or Manny Pacquiao. He'd take either fight. He'd be paid a lot of money for either fight. So all he has to do is go in there and look good on Saturday, or just win on Saturday. I'm sure that'll coincide with looking good, and he'll get one of those fights later this year.
Yeah, and he certainly would be a marketable opponent for either one of those guys, Spence or Pacquiao, that you mentioned. And but not to pivot too far off, but I'm with you on the Joe Smith stuff. The fact that Jesse Hart was favored was insane. Like, that
four,
was nuts.
4-1.
Like, Jesse had one win at light heavyweight over Sullivan Barrera, who was a fraction of what he once was. And he's going up against Joe Smith, who, yes, I guess he is a gatekeeper, but he's as tough a gatekeeper as you could possibly get. Like, you need to be as disciplined as Dimitri Bivol was to keep Joe Smith off you. If you aren't, and Jesse Hart clearly is not, Joe Smith is going to gobble you up at that weight class. So right. I wasn't surprised at all by that. Real quick, let me ask you, the 154-pound division is fascinating right now because you get all these guys who are beating each other, and they're all on the PBC side of the street. I think it's great for that division to have all these guys who are the top-tier fighters, the top-tier 154-pounders. Patrick Teixeira could even cross over because he's not some super marketable guy that Golden Boy has. You could have guys fighting for titles. You could throw Tony Harrison back in the mix. Charlo is going to get a big fight. I think this could be a huge year for these 154-pound fighters to really make names for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, this really threw a monkey wrench into everything with Jason Rosario beating Julian Williams, because I think if Williams would have won as he was expected to do, we would have probably seen Williams fight Jermell Charlo later this year, and there would have been something to that fight because Jermell Charlo had knocked out Julian Williams, and that would have been his only loss going into that fight, and they were the two top guys in the junior middleweight division, and that would have been a marketable fight. So now we won't, I don't know what to make of Rosario at this point. This is a guy who's been stopped by Nathaniel Gallimore, but he had, according to him, the only real training camp of his entire career leading into the Williams fight. He spent 16 weeks in Miami, so he says he's a different fighter when he trains the right way. The evidence is there that he is a different fighter when he puts in a real training camp because of what he did last Saturday night. So we'll see how real he is later this year, but we're going to see Jared Herd fight on Saturday night in his first fight coming off of his first loss to Julian Williams. We'll see what he's about now. I don't think he's going to be tested against Francisco Santana, who's really a welterweight with 7 losses, but maybe Herd winds up fighting Jermell Charlo later this year, or Herd winds up fighting Rosario, although Williams has said that he's going to exercise his rematch clause immediately, so I think we're probably going to see that rematch later this year. And then maybe Herd winds up fighting Jermell Charlo while Williams is fighting Rosario in the rematch. And I wouldn't mind seeing Herd fight Charlo. I mean, I'd be interested in that fight. I think a lot of people would. So there are plenty of options there at 154 on the PBC side of it. And then, like you said, Teixeira factors into it. It was an impressive win that he had against Carlos Adames. So we'll see. He only has that one loss on his record when he got knocked out against Curtis Stevens. So, there could be some interesting fights to be made at 154 later this year. One fight
Jared Herd versus Charlo, one of those two should fight Charlo, like, or one of those two should fight Teixeira and make a fight. Like, it's just, I don't think Golden Boy would do it, but there's really no need to have Teixeira fighting, you know, nobody's on that side of the street. He's just not going to become this marketable star over there. So just see, roll the dice, see if he can, you know, catch lightning in a bottle and win another big fight. Then maybe you might have something with Patrick Teixeira. Keith, always appreciate it, man. Great talking to you, and we'll catch up sometime soon.
Could I just end this on one thing, Chris? I didn't mean to cut you off. I'm sorry. But just to go back to what we started this podcast with, what this McGregor-Crawford talk has done has left people asking the question of whether Crawford would fight McGregor or McGregor would fight Crawford, when the real question is, who is Terrence Crawford going to fight next? That's the real question. And there's no real answer to it, because none of these PBC fights are available, and Top Rank doesn't have anyone, especially now that Besputin has, you know, failed a drug test and probably will be stripped of his version of the WBA title. Who is Terrence Crawford going to fight next? And it's not going to be Conor McGregor, so who is it going to be?
Do you have an answer to that question?
No. I don't think any of us have answers, but I think that it takes this McGregor storyline for a couple of days anyway, maybe a week, takes the focus off what the real question is. And I'm sure it's the question that Terrence Crawford has himself. If I can't get the fights that I want with the PBC guys, which he's not going to get next, other than Sean Porter, and I still don't understand why they can't fight, despite their friendship, who is he fighting next?
Yeah, I don't know.
That's a question, right?
The idea of Teixeira has been floated a little bit, and I think that's something that would interest Golden Boy and Patrick Teixeira, and maybe if you're Crawford, jumping up another weight class to get a title at least gets your kind of juices flowing there. But the welterweight division, it's all on the other side, and there's not even like a mean machine type that is out there that you could fight as a potential mandatory. It's complicated, man. It really is. And I'm not sure what, you know, Bob Arum and his people there are going to do with this guy. It's troubling.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be interesting to see what they come up with.
Yeah, no kidding. Keith, again, appreciate it, man. We'll catch up soon.
Always, Chris. Appreciate the time, man.